Hello and welcome to the Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm your host, Twin Lou. I am joined by the Fan Morning Show's Blake Murphy, as we do every Tuesday. Producer, hit it.
Blake Murphy.
Tuesday!
Blake, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I am doing well. How was the morning?
Oh, it's good. It's just, you know how Tuesdays are, good drop aside. This is the day my knees start to feel a little like Fred Van Vliet's from the heavy usage. Got a little knee soreness going on, you know. I guess it's butt soreness from just sitting at the desk all day, but you know how it is.
Yeah. No, even bloggers need a load of management from here or there. So, okay, let's start with that then. Fred Van Vliet is questionable, according to the most recent injury report here, for the game tonight against the Charlotte Hornets. Yeah, so let me just read you Fred's minutes of late. Obviously, this has been a concern. It's been a talking point. But, you know, okay, so the Pelicans game, dating back, you know, 2 weeks now, 39 minutes, 11 seconds. The next game, Phoenix, 43 minutes, 41 seconds. The next game, Detroit, 42 minutes, 17 seconds. A loss, by the way. 41 minutes and 39 seconds. A win over the Milwaukee Bucks. 40 minutes, 40 seconds in a game where they lose to Miami at the end. 41 minutes, 37 seconds against Dallas. 39 minutes against Washington. And now 41 minutes and 40 seconds in a loss to Portland. Blake, this sounds like your usage.
It's a lot, man. That's eight in a row. 39 minutes or higher.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare. This guy is leading the league in minutes per game. You know, and we can talk all we want about, hey, well, there are other things going on other than minutes per game. There's, you know, what kind of rest they're getting, what's a practice workload like, all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, when you have four guys in the top 13 in minutes played per game, top 14 rather, you are obviously leaning on those guys a lot. And, you know, even if you have a strong belief in your sports science staff, it's a lot. And it's not as if, Fred is, you know, I don't think he's injury prone, but he's missed a little bit of time in most of his seasons with wear and tear stuff, because it's not only the minutes load, but he plays a really aggressive style. He's everywhere on defense. He's physical. He takes a lot of hard falls, and it's just like, this many games in a row at 39 minutes is just not something you see in the NBA all that often anymore. So those eight games in a row at 39 minutes, that's the highest streak of that kind of playing time in the league this season. Pascal Siakam right behind him with seven in a row. He didn't quite cross that threshold last game, so his streak ended. And then Tyrese Maxey is the only other guy that's done it more than four games in a row this year. He had a six-game streak. So pretty rare to see guys play 39, 40 minutes, eight games in a row. And even if they're not back-to-backs and it's not, you know, again, there are a million qualifiers you could throw at this of, oh, maybe it's not that bad. There's only one back-to-back in that mix. You know, he gets practice days off. You're still at the extreme. No one else is doing this in the league. Van Vliet and Siakam are carrying a far greater minutes load than just about anyone else.
Yeah. You know, look, I don't want to be
I shouldn't exclude OG. Sorry. He's third in the league in minutes per game.
Yeah, that's right. Clearly this is a pattern. And I think, look, there's a lot of factors that go into this. It's not just Nick. It's also the fact that the bench has not had a lot of depth on it at all. So, you know, plus some injuries. And so they want to play some of these minutes. And honestly, I did agree with the approach of you want to play your best guys against the best teams. Give yourself a great chance to win. And they gave their best shot against a lot of these clubs. And whether you look at the Dallas game, which was unfortunate, came down to one possession. The Miami game came down to one possession. The Phoenix game came down to one possession. You know, it's easier to swallow, I guess, if they get some of those wins. But, of course, this was always the risk. And you know what? Hopefully this is just something that is short-term, is something that is not recurring, you know. We do know that the Raptors' history with when they put a guy surprised at the last second questionable on the list that they're probably not going to play, but just hoping for the best, honestly, because he's clearly way too important. I mean, like, I'm not even sure what would you do if Fred's not in. Like, I think Nick might still not play Malachi, which we will get to later on. But what would you do without Fred?
I think Delano becomes the backup point guard, and I think they start gigantic. I think Pascal would basically be the starting point guard at that point. I don't see a scenario where they're throwing maybe Banton, but they're certainly not throwing Malachi Flynn in, I don't think. And Nick's shown he's willing to throw a guy in to the starting lineup without having been in the rotation. Like, there's the this might have been a Dwayne Casey year still, but there's the old Malcolm Miller, you've never played, but we're going to start you. There's the Utah, you're fresh from COVID, and we're going to start you. I don't think Malachi Flynn is working into the mix here. Let me ask you a question, Will. So,
yeah, go ahead.
The Raptors are a 500 team. They're right around the league median and things like net rating and simple rating system. And basically, they're as average a team as you can get. When you're trying to analyze this team, though, and Charlotte's a good example tonight, because Charlotte would have Miles Bridges ranked fourth on the Raptors in minutes per game and Gordon Hayward sixth. That's their two top heaviest minutes guys. The Raptors have players ranked first, third, sixth, and 14th overall in the league. Do you think that this is a complicating factor that we should be taking into account when evaluating this team? And I don't even mean the injury risk. I mean, if you get to a play-in game or a playoff series, other teams have the benefit of shortening the rotations, playing their main guys more, but the Raptors won't have that ability to kind of project ahead a boost. They'll be who they are because we're seeing a playoff rotation for them most of the time.
Yeah, I think that's a totally fair point. I mean, especially of late, you're seeing like game seven level rotations. When you're talking about six-man rotations for two games where they played in two separate halves, that's like a game seven scenario. I think Nick might have actually played more people in the game seven against Philadelphia than he did in on the road against Milwaukee or even the second half against Detroit and things like this. And, you know, whatever. I think these are things that you can look at in hindsight. Again, I don't want to be hypocritical. Like, I did agree with them trying to compete as best as possible, but that's a great point. Like, a lot of these teams will be able to shorten the rotation to a degree. I think they're maybe on the other front, though. I do think there is something to be learned about, like, players, like, getting used to playing really heavy minutes and being able to sustain that effort over an extended period. You know what I'm saying? Like, sometimes you can't just necessarily tell a guy who plays 30 minutes to go out there and play 42 and expect the same per minute level of production.
I do understand that. I don't know that it's the case with Fred and Pascal, who have shown they can do it, right?
Maybe.
And Scotty's a rookie. Like, I would get that a little bit more if you're trying to see it with the Precious or Kem or you know, one of those guys who hasn't played the big minutes before. But Fred Pascal and OG have been up in the 30s before. By the way, you mentioned game seven against Philadelphia. Fred VanVleet played 15 minutes as the seventh man. So they did run a deeper rotation that game.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty incredible. But also, you know, this is kind of what Nick, this has kind of been the pattern with Nick, right? Like, this is, I know people make the nicknames like Nick Thibodeau or whatever. Like, it's not necessarily untrue. Like, we've seen this happen before. And again, just hopefully Fred is not out long term. The Raptors don't have a backup point guard. I mean, they in fact don't play one. I understand that you can go to those kind of lineups. Like, for example, so Fred's missed three games this year. They've lost all three games. Now, some context. One game was the game where Goran Dragic randomly started against Detroit. And then after the game, Goran's like, yeah, I'm pretty tired, man. I don't really do this basketball thing. This is a lot for me. I'm going to leave the team now. So that was that game that they lost. The other game that they lost was the Cleveland game, which was a farce. And I feel like that is also dragging down the overall numbers, how badly they lost in that game. But whatever, that was the game, I guess. And then the other game, which was probably the most informative, was when the Raptors lost to the Sixers. And they didn't have Fred back for that one. He was still in protocol. And the starters they went with in that game, Pascal Siakam, Gary Trent Jr., Chris Boucher, Malachi Flynn, Yuta Watanabe. Now, granted, they were coming off the bench with Svi, DJ Wilson, Tremont Waters, and Daniel Otoru. So this means that the Raptors had a couple of other guys injured. But when you look at how that game was played, Pascal was the de facto point guard. He had 8 assists in that game. Gary even had 7 assists as well. Malachi played, I guess, but was really, really empty in the production, 2 of 12. I doubt Nick turns back to that look. And yeah, I guess we're just going to go with the nice lineup right out top, the all 6'9 lineup.
there aren't a lot of choices there. Gary's a little shorter, so maybe you get the benefit of that. So he's the, I don't know, he plays the short man in however you want to roll that out. But it's not, I don't see the point. I don't really see well, I see the point. It's because you need point guard play, but to shoot Malachi into there, I don't really know. So I looked at some of the most commonly used lineups that don't include Fred VanVleet or that game that Dragic started. The Siakam, Anunoby, Barnes, Boucher, Achiuwa has played the most with 21 minutes. There's another one that's played 19 that won't be available because Birch won't be playing in this one. There's one that has Flynn and Watanabe that played 18 minutes in one game, if you remember that game. And then then we're getting into DJ Wilson was out there for 10 minutes and things like that. So you really don't have much sample here other than that kind of Anunoby as the smallest guy on the floor lineup. That's really the only one you've got to look at. Smaller samples with Trent in that spot and still two bigs. But basically what I'm saying is this is a mess. Whatever we see tonight is going to be, if Fred VanVleet doesn't play, what we're going to see is either untested or very unproven.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be a struggle, especially because the next point I actually had before, honestly, even coming up with this report, is just the fact that I wanted to ask you about the Raptors of late. They've been struggling a lot with zone coverages, and we've seen this against Miami. Miami pulled out a zone. That's a team that plays zone anyway. I don't know if that was necessarily even purposeful against the Raptors. They probably play zone anyway, but they used the zone, had some pretty good results against the Raptors. Dallas used a zone. That also kind of changed the game against the Raptors. Washington definitely uses zone. The Raptors are up 18 in the fourth quarter. Washington switches to a zone, and the Raptors end up having to play in a game where they were tied in the last minute, and then Fred comes up with a big three to put them ahead. OG with the putback to secure the win. And then Portland also played a zone for a heavy stretch there when the Raptors were really getting down in the first half. And so let's just start here. Why are the Raptors struggling so much with zone in particular?
Well, the big part of it is just they don't have a lot of shooting, right? And even at full strength or when guys aren't as fatigued, they're not an elite shooting team, I don't think. Fred is a plus shooter. OG Anunoby and Gary Trent are plus shooters for their position. Svi, if he plays, has the threat of a shot. It just never goes in. And then you're looking at, and even OG and Gary Trent are both shooting below their career rates this year, in part because they're being tasked with more self-creation threes. So right now, the only guys that qualify who are shooting above the league average are VanVleet and Trent. So big picture, this is just not a good shooting team. They're shooting 34% on threes this year. I think another factor is whether it's fatigue or whether it's the lineup or playing multiple bigs at a time, or whether it's, just a randomness. The Raptors have shot really, really poorly over these last seven games in particular. They've only shot league average twice, and they haven't shot better than 36.5% from three in any of these last seven games. So the other thing is, this just isn't all that new, right? Like the Raptors, they do rank 18th in the league in points per possession against the zone, but that's a bit of a misnomer because not that many teams get zoned up as much as they do. So I think a better indicator is how often are teams zoning you up. And in that regard, well, the Raptors rank pretty a little above average, but we've seen it a ton this last little bit. And we've seen it, there's that infamous Miami game where they shot, I don't know, 3 for 100 or whatever it was on three.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, man. That was painful. That game ended in the 80s.
Yeah. And you look at some of the ways you want to beat a zone, and it's a lot of cutting. It's a lot of passing. It's a lot of stick and move. And you need the threat of three-point shooting. And I'm not sure a bunch of guys who take pull-up threes is the best way to beat that because, first of all, the guys at the top of the zone are going to close out against those, and you generally don't have great offensive rebounding position, at least in those lineups without a traditional center. And the other one is good playmaking. And the Raptors have good playmakers. And I thought Scotty Barnes has looked pretty decent as the kind of the guy at the nail against the zone who's passing out of that spot. He needs more reps there. But this is a team that ranks in the bottom five or bottom six in assist percentage. And you don't want to pass the ball just for the sake of passing it, but they're not stylistically equipped to attack a zone like that. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is beyond, hey, put more shooting out there, or try to use your vertical threats in Boucher and Achiuwa to kind of, you know, lob your way against the zone if the other team doesn't have a good rim protecting big who's comfortable in zone. But mostly this is, you got to shoot better. Than you can't be, you know, you can't be bottom 10 in the league in 3-point shooting and also, you know, be in a cold streak on top of that.
Yeah, and I think especially that duo of Precious and Chris, I think that's where teams, at least from what I've sort of just observed so far, like, seems like when those guys come into the game, that's when teams really say to themselves, okay, that's two guys who are not playmakers, who are not guys who shoot. I mean, Boucher, I guess, has hit shots at a higher rate of late, but generally speaking, teams aren't guarding him, you know, that hard. So they say to themselves, well, when these two guys come in, we're going to zone up. And I thought Portland was the perfect example that that's when they first went to their zone. And they stayed in that zone for quite a while. And it neutralized a lot of what the Raptors want to do. And so, I mean, I guess, obviously, the personnel, at least right now, is not going to specifically change. Maybe after the trade deadline, we'll see what the Raptors do. And I'll definitely ask you about that in the second half of the show today. But let's just talk about the players on the roster right now. Are there, like, certain counters that you would like to see? Do you see things in terms of execution where they're just, like, you know, perhaps not screening well, for example, where, you know, they could probably improve a little bit, at least in the meantime? Because I think Nick and his coaching staff absolutely needs to be looking at this particular strategy that teams are using against them, which is ironic. Obviously, Nick introduced a lot of zone play back into the NBA. But, like, how, you know, he has to be looking at his staff and whether they're doing practices or walkthroughs or whatever. Like, they need to – this has to be a big focus. Because I'm pretty sure Charlotte's going to zone them, especially if Fred's not going to play.
Yeah, they're definitely going to zone up. And I don't – you know, I don't know what their comfort level is with that. I know there are some coaches, especially with the younger team, that they don't want to completely overhaul their, the way that they play defense just for, you know, one night against an opponent, and especially an opponent like you're going to see again. And you probably want to measure yourself against, because you do, you know, operate in the same kind of tier of the league. You know, Charlotte is a team that really hasn't used the zone much. I had the leaderboard reversed. Will, they zone more than anyone in the league.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Yeah. So they're definitely going to zone. Yeah. Maybe the whole
10.9% of their defensive possessions have been logged as zone per synergy. That includes opponents shooting just 0.85 points per possession, against it. So this is, I would have loved to say that I knew this stat ahead of time and we set up the show this way, but like I just stumbled over, I had the leaderboards upside down. Charlotte is well equipped to at least try to make the Raptors beat them via zone defense. So one thing is screening. Yeah, that's something you could do a little bit more of. They really miss Kem Birch in that regard lately, where Achiuwa and Boucher are more there. The threat of their screen is that they're going to roll. And there's a vertical threat there. It's not that they're going to pin a guy, and neither is, you know, Boucher shot a little bit better of late, but he's at 28% on the season, and Precious has basically, you know, stopped shooting them at this point. So maybe it's a case where you need to involve Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam as screeners more, maybe even OG Anunoby as screeners more. That way there's a threat on both sides of the screen and roll. I don't know, man, more baseline cuts, more off-ball movement, but it's not something that they're, especially without Fred, particularly well-equipped to attack.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's my real concern. And I think this is something that, you know, if you look ahead to a playoff scenario, if the Raptors get to that point, teams are probably going to do this in the playoffs against the Raptors, and it'll be even more frustrating to watch. And I think in this particular sense, like, there's some small things they can do better in execution. Like, I was even just watching, like, Samson Folk wrote a great piece about this at Raps Republic after the loss to Portland. And he highlighted some of the plays where the Raptors were specifically attacking the zone and their zone offense, right, against what Portland did. And there was a play where Fred hit the three coming off a set of double screens. And the first screen was good from Scotty, right? That got him most of the separation. But the screen from Boucher, there was another screen from Precious on the other side of the floor. Like, they both missed their screens. Like, they just failed to make contact. Luckily, Fred was able to catch and shoot really quickly and make it. But, like, you know, there's just things that you can do better in terms of making actual contact with the screens and making sure that you create as much space as possible for your shooters. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure we'll see it tonight. And I think that, you know, the lack of shooting is a problem on the roster. And when you look at the Raptors, you know, this is from John Schumann, where the Raptors' effective field goal percentage is 27th this season, right? And that's, you know, if you take the regular field goal percentage and then you add in an extra point for threes, obviously you're not counting for free throws or anything like that, but only the Thunder, the Pistons, and the Magic are lower than the Raptors in effective field goal percentage. And actually, if you look at it, so it's a bit of a strange trend going on where the Raptors were last season in terms of like the money ball shots, right? The best shots on the floor, which are restricted area shots and also threes in terms of the highest points per possession. The Raptors were fifth last year in taking their share of money ball shots at 74% of their shots were in these high percentage zones. Now they're down to 26 in the NBA with only 65% of their shots within these sort of ranges. And when you look at the numbers individually, it's been the fifth biggest drop year over year in the NBA in restricted area rates. So they're getting to the rim less, but more importantly, it's the biggest drop in the NBA in terms of three-point attempt rate. Like, they're just shooting far fewer threes. And obviously, we understand. You take Kyle out of the lineup, he was shooting like 10 threes a game. You replace him with Precious and Scotty. You know, that's just not the same level of shooting, not even close. But at the same time, like, are there anything else in terms of the shot diet or the shot selection that's starting to concern you? With the Raptors having played half a year, let's be real. This is like not some sort of aberration.
We're certainly not looking at a small sample at this point. And sure, small sample of, you know, guys who, small sample of lineups and small sample of players in and out and stuff like that. But yeah, this is just, it's not a team with a ton of shooting talent. And that can be okay. And, you know, I'm sure there are people who, hey, they're probably glad and rightly so maybe that the Raptors are taking fewer threes than last year because they don't have the talent for it, right? Like you kind of want to match your offensive profile to the guys you have. Now, I would say that you would ideally be trading those threes in for shots at the rim and not, you know, mid-range looks like deep floater range or the kind of pull-up twos. The other thing too is that the Raptors are like within that three-point breakdown is that the Raptors take over 23 they only take 23 catch and shoot threes a game, which is a bottom 10 number. And it also means that, yeah, they're shooting more pull-up threes, which are more difficult. They shoot 36% on those catch and shoot threes, and they don't shoot nearly as nobody shoots as well on pull-ups. But you also, if you're the Raptors, you probably shouldn't be taking 11.3 a game then and hit it. Like, so of all the teams in the league that are shooting, you know, I don't know, 10% or more of their shots at, or 10 pull-up threes a game or more, the Raptors are the only one shooting 30% or lower. The Clippers are the only other one, and they only make a cutoff by a fraction. So there just aren't many examples of teams taking this many pull-up threes ineffectively and teams, you know, moving away from the catch and shoot threes. So again, some of it is personnel. You don't have a pick and roll orchestrator when Fred goes to the bench. You don't have, you know, this guy for a bit and that guy for a bit, but the end result is kind of the worst, these last couple games, the worst version of what we feared coming into the season. It's that there just isn't a lot of ways for this team to create half court offense against a set defense. They've succeeded largely because they don't turn the ball over. They hit the offensive glass like crazy, and they're a very good transition team. Almost none of the success or them being 500 has to do with the half court offense being effective.
Yeah, and again, that's another thing when you look at to the playoffs. It's one of those things that is a little concerning. You definitely will feel a lot more comfortable not being 27th in effective field goal percentage. I mean, that's very obvious. I don't know why I said that. Okay, all right, last thing I wanted to get to before we get to the break is the starting lineup. It's just, there's been a trend of late to see the starting lineup, and by that I mean Scotty at center, Pascal at 4, OG at 3, Gary at 2, Fred at 1. It's been a trend of late. So see that starting lineup start slowly. And not, they didn't have this specific starting lineup for all of these games. So I don't want to specifically say it's just this group, but maybe it's just in general. The Raptors are getting off to slow starts. When you look at the game where they beat Milwaukee, which was great, one of the three times they did it, they gave up 77 points by halftime. The game where they beat Utah, where Fred went like Super Saiyan in the third quarter, Utah had 40 points in the first quarter. And that was a game where pretty much any recognizable Jazz player was not there. So that was tough. The Miami game, they get down 29-20. I didn't think they played that badly, but still, you know, that's not good to be down 9 points after just a quarter. In the Washington game, where they came back and won, they started 10-3. Nick had to call the first timeout. They were down 30-20 after the first quarter. And then, of course, this culminates in the Portland game, where they're down 34 points at one point in the first half. They go down 30 points at half, and they started the game 25-4. And that's the Raptors starting lineup against a Blazers starting lineup that wasn't that bad, really, but like still missing two starters in Dame and Norm Powell. So what is behind this? Like, why are the Raptors starting off so slow? Like, I don't want to hear necessarily about the empty gym or anything like that, because a lot of these games are played on the road too, you know?
Also,
is it like a starting lineup issue?
The other team's playing in an empty gym too.
Yeah.
So it's tough. So with that fivesome, they have a negative 6.4 net rating on the season as a whole. 122 minutes is not a great sample, but it's the second largest sample we have. And that sample with Precious Achiuwa in place of Siakam was more effective. And you can cut that up different ways. You get Siakam and Achiuwa in there and OG out, and it's better. And I think there are so many iterations of these five players that have worked in 3- and 4-man units that you can trust it to eventually normalize. They'll figure it out. But I think, you know, to kind of round this back to a point we were making in the preseason when we looked at what this rotation looks like, I think the best version of this team probably starts Kem Birch and brings one of the other guys, probably Gary Trent, off the bench. Now, I'm not advocating you do that necessarily, because Gary's been good, and right now, you know, Kem Birch isn't around anyway. But I think you look at, hey, what's the biggest weakness in these second units? Well, it's that no one with the bench units can score and no one with the bench units can shoot. And that requires you to play Svi or a 7-man rotation. And Gary Trent can maybe alleviate some of that. And again, not a negative about Gary Trent Jr. as much as, hey, what fits where and how do you maximize the 48 minutes? Gary's probably still going to close games. So I don't know. That's where I'm at with it. I don't feel super strongly about it, just because you get three or four of those five guys on the court, and most of the different lineups with any sample have worked. So I don't think there's one thing standing out of, hey, this can't work. It's just, it hasn't in that 122 minute sample. And obviously a lot of like multicollinearity here with different guys being tired and the opponent and randomness and stuff like that. But yeah, you just can't get out the starts like this. Like, you're not the championship level Raptors team that can do the, hey, we lead the league in double digit comebacks multiple seasons in a row because we're good and we only need one good quarter to win. This team is not that good. You need probably at least three good quarters to win, ideally four. And I know we're being a little reductive here and oversimplifying things, but you were down 34 points early to a really bad Portland team. Like, you just have to start games better than that. There's no other way around it. And I don't know. Some of that will normalize. Some of that, I think at a certain point, they might need to be like, hey, look, we gave that smaller 5, 9, 10 games starting, and it's a cool closing lineup and a cool show me lineup, but we need to try something else and see how that works.
Yeah, fair enough. And honestly, if you look at the pattern of some of these games, Nick has called a quick timeout and pulled guys early in a lot of these lineups, right? Washington, that happened. He pulled Scotty after 2 minutes, right? You know, Miami, he made some adjustments there too. And Utah, same thing. So yeah, I don't know if he's like specifically like married to it. I mean, anytime, obviously most of the guys are available, he's going to this lineup, but I think, yeah, they have to set the tone better too. Like, I know they can make a comeback, and they have. Like, they've made a comeback in all these games. They were in all these games. They won like three of the couple games here that I described, but you know, it's just a bad pattern. It's going to be a really bad habit. So we're going to take a quick break right here. When we come back on the other side, we will talk about trade deadline strategy for the Toronto Raptors. So I'm your host, Will Liu. You've been listening to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Welcome back to The Raptor Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I'm your host, Wim Liu. I continue to be joined by The Fan Morning Show's Blake Murphy. We will get to the Raptors trade talk in a second, but first we have to recount the Raptors, fairly exciting game. The Raptors 9-5 defeating the Westchester Knicks, coming back from behind. Obviously, a lot of synergy between the big club and the G League, because they're even practicing making comebacks. Raptors coming back from down 11. Honestly, the Knicks were playing quite well, and they held a lead for a lot of it. But a 35-23 fourth quarter for the Raptors 9-5 to finish out with the win. That includes 23 points with Delano Banton in the fourth quarter. He was sensational, going down there once again, putting up 30 points like it's nothing. And this is even after a pretty slow start. But you wanted to talk about Yuta Watanabe, who was down there for a conditioning stint.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, Delano looked good, especially late. It's an interesting translation because he goes down there and he's much more score-oriented. And there's a bit of an adjustment period, I think, at times for the other 905ers to come down and have a guard who's a little bit more score-first. It's also just, it's a little surprising to see Delano operate that way, but maybe that's what he's been instructed. And, you know, it's effective. You score 31 points on 18 field goal attempts and only have two turnovers the whole game. You're looking pretty good. But I did want to talk about Yuta Watanabe. So Yuta played 39 minutes in that one. Really good game overall, 24 and 10, four block shots, hit four threes. You saw the stuff you'd want to see from him. He was plus six in a 7-point win. But it's more the off the court stuff from last night that I wanted to mention with Yuta Watanabe. So, you know, we'd heard pregame that he asked for the assignment. You know, he hadn't seen a lot of minutes since he came back from COVID. He was obviously struggling a little bit with the Raptors, and he wanted to get the work in. But Kelsey O'Brien from our old stomping ground, Raptors Republic, relayed a story at Raptors Republic today that not only did Yuta ask to go down, he opened his post-game scrum thanking the other players on the team, because having done 2 years with the Memphis Hustle, he is very aware that sometimes when NBA guys come down, you know, that's great, and that's what the G League's for from the NBA lens, but that is difficult for the guys down there who are trying to get better and who are trying to show out and who are trying to, you know, make their own mark. That's Yuta goes down and plays 39 minutes. That's 39 minutes that aren't going to Josh Hall and Jody Meeks and Aaron Best and Alex Antetokounmpo. So I thought it was great that Yuta took the time out to thank those players. And based on Kelsey's write-up of the game, he also you know, took responsibility from a leadership perspective in the huddles and in the locker room, that it was the assignment guys who weren't carrying their weight for a good chunk of that game when they got behind. Like, you look at the box score, Justin Smith plus 15, Aaron Best plus 22, Ashton Haggins plus 28. That's in a 7-point win. It was that starting lineup that wasn't getting it done. So a lot of great Yuta stuff on the court, but even better off the court. And I think, you know, you if you've wondered why the Raptors have liked this guy so much, or why there's been patience with his injury and his development, it's because he's a big time culture fit in that regard. And you know, hopefully that's a step forward. He's back in the NBA rotation tonight.
I think you'll get some minutes tonight. I think it's a fairly good bet. And by the way, the 905 have done really well since like the regular season for them started. There was like a showcase period. It was like a whatever. But like, yeah, since the regular season started, they're 8-10 or 8-2 in 10 games. And yeah, I mean, some of the guys I watched down there, like, they look pretty good. Like, I've continued to be pretty impressed. Most games when I watch Kevon Harris, he's like a big. He didn't have a big game yesterday. Wasn't, you know, that good overall, but just like, big bodies, able to make a couple of plays, you know, take some contact, drive hard to the rim, make some threes. Pretty good defensively as well, I thought. Reggie Perry keeps putting up numbers. Like, he was almost like the number one option. Like, it's just like Malachi kept wanting to play pick and roll with him. Delano kept wanting to pick and roll with him. He got a lot of touches. But Aaron Best, shout out Aaron Best, he just looks like he's, you know, worked on his three a lot, and it's just a lot smoother. And I don't think it's like his best role to like play catch and shoot all the time, because I think he's more of a downhill kind of guard, but he's been hitting the three pretty decently. But yeah, I mean, you know, Utah Ken that went down there, I thought he didn't intrude too much. You might even say, well, you know, you do want him to be more aggressive. Well, I mean, 18 shots in 40 minutes is pretty good for Utah. It's probably about as much as he'll do. I thought Delano actually did a good job of like not taking over really, and then waiting till the fourth quarter, and he's like, it's winning time, I could change the game, and then he did it. I mean, it's kind of similar to the last game that he played, where he had 33, I believe, and he had 25 and a half. Like, he has that takeover ability, which is exactly what you want to see from some of these guys going down there. The concern, though, for me is Malachi Flynn continues to struggle when he goes down there. I went through some of the game logs on the show last week of him in the G League, so I don't want to go over it again. but just rest assured that they're like basically 30% shooting with a lot of pull-up jumpers. And today, when I look at the box score again from what he did last night, 5 of 14 from the field, 1 of 6 from 3, only 2 assists. You know, I some of those plays, I guess he set up Reggie Perry to get to the free throw line or whatever, but ultimately not a very effective shift for Malachi. And if for people who are wondering, like, why isn't Malachi playing? Why is Delano getting time over him, even though Delano's a rookie and Malachi's in his second year? Well, when they go down to the same level and they're both given a big chance to, like, play a lot of minutes and see what they can do, Malachi played 37 minutes. He doesn't do much down there other than take contested shots, and that's not what wins games at any level, really.
No, it's not. And it's, I guess it's a little tough because he's in a different spot, right? Like, Utah's going down there on a conditioning stint. Delano's going down there on a get better stint. Malachi's going down there in this nebulous purpose, right? Like, are you trying to get rotation minutes? Well, I don't know, because last couple times you went down, you came back up and you didn't get rotation minutes. Are you trying to prove that you're too good for the G League? Because you kind of did that last year, and then your play went in the opposite direction. So it's probably a difficult thing for him to go up and down like that. I haven't spoken to him about this. I haven't been around the team, but I would imagine that the way his season has played out has had a psychological toll. And I don't mean necessarily, you know, he's down on himself or whatever, but you probably question some things about your game when what got you to the show isn't keeping you in the show now. And then there's also just the awkwardness of you send two point guards down, right? And it's, you know, how do you roll the ball out? How do you operate that way? There's not, you know, Romaro Gill is a nice finisher around the rim sometimes, but there's not a, you know, same kind of issue you have at the NBA level. There's not a natural pick and roll partner for Malachi Flynn there. So I don't know. There's a lot of things, but, you know, big picture, Malachi Flynn just hasn't been very good when he's gone down there. And that's at the end of the day, like, no offense to him. And I think anyone who's listened to my stuff or read my stuff knows that I was pretty high on him through last year and even through summer league. You got to make more of those opportunities when you go down there. You got to, and I don't mean hog the ball and take 30 shots, but you got to look like more of the pick and roll point guard and the floor general and stuff that you were getting hyped up as, because this isn't it. Like, 3.5 assists to 3 turnovers over 4 games and 16 points per game on really shaky shooting is just, it's not it.
Yeah, it's not it. And you know what? It is a little awkward. I agree when you put down two point guards down there. I thought it was very much like a my turn, your turn situation with Malachi dominating the ball for a possession and Delano trying to initiate for a possession. And especially in the first half, that's kind of what it felt like. There was a very little like flow and sort of team game to it. But he's got to show more. He's got to show more. And I'm surprised that he got called back up because honestly, I think Malachi could use like a month down there, you know, just to get his feet right and everything like that.
And you send the message, right, of, hey, you're going down here for this amount of time, and don't look over your shoulder and don't worry about a call-up because we're going to give you a little bit of runway here. And this would be the time because the Raptors, other than Ken Burch, are fairly healthy now. I know Fred might not play tonight, so this talking point maybe changes a little bit. But you also, you know, I'm not even worried about the deadline with Malachi because I don't think anything he'd show in 5-6 minutes at a time at the NBA level would change much. But you go down there and, hey, get your head right, get your game right. And if you're still a part of this team post-deadline, we'll look to get you back in the rotation. I just think a little bit of clarity like that on what the plan is for him would be helpful. And sorry, I say this is a good time for it because in addition to, you know, the deadline's ahead and they have guys ahead of them on the depth chart and they're getting back to health, it's also that the 905 are at home for a really extended stretch right now. Like, they're in the middle of a stretch of 10 home games in 11 games. And the Raptors are, you know, home, away, home, away. You could sit them down there and it's like, hey, you're in Mississauga for a couple weeks, get 6, 7, 8 games in.
Yeah. And that feels like that's what he kind of needs, you know, because his career so far has been really like up and down, up and down, up and down in terms of the opportunity, the minutes and everything like that. But also, man, when you play, like, you got to do something. Like, that's 37 minutes. He had plenty of the ball. Like, it's tough. Okay, let's talk about the Raptors trade deadline strategy. So our very own Michael Grange of Sportsnet put out a piece today sort of outlining the front office's position. And I'm going to read to you a couple of things and get your thoughts on sort of where the Raptors are in the trade deadline. So Grange reports that the goal for the front office is to scour the market for pieces that can augment the group now and in the future. And by the group, he's talking about the core. And he said about the core, quote, the club has essentially ruled out trading any of who they define as their core, which is Fred VanVleet, Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby, and Scotty Barnes. They're not going anywhere next month. In addition, the Raptors are actively gauging the potential return if they attach future assets, a first-round pick at minimum, to their one quote-unquote no-brainer trade chip, which is Goran Dragic's expiring $19.4 million contract, which can obviously be used both as an expiring deal for the team acquiring him, but also just as a way to move salaries around for the Raptors to take in an additional player. Obviously, Goran's deal in and of itself is not holding that much value, unless maybe, let's say, the Raptors take on a salary dump, but otherwise, it's that first-round pick that they could be attaching. And, okay, so Blake, a first-round pick with Goran, like that, what would, like, I'm assuming this is a lot. This got to be a lottery protected pick. I mean, the Raptors aren't like for sure going to make the playoffs, so you definitely need to lottery protect this pick, especially if it's for this upcoming year. Yeah,
I would think so. So let's make a couple assumptions here. So the first assumption I want to clear is that, yeah, let's say it's lotto protected. That way, if they lose the play, maybe it's not even lotto protected. Maybe it's top 10 protected because a team would be like, well, you might make the play-in game and lose, and we want that, but if you win the lottery or move up in the lottery, then you're okay. So I don't think it would be a completely unprotected pick. It's just probabilistically, it's too weird. The other assumption would be that the Raptors are not willing to go into the tax. They are very, very tight to the tax right now, to where if you traded out Goran, you could throw Malachi Flynn in as well if you needed to. But let's say Goran Dragic at 19 and change, you also need to take back slightly less money, both to clear wiggle room under the tax for Gary Trent's bonuses that could hit, but also you would need to sign guys to those open roster spots. And ideally you'd use one of those spots on a developmental flyer down the stretch anyway. So this is the tier of guy salary-wise that you're potentially looking at. Eric Gordon is one. In mm-hmm. Houston, he's 30 years old. He has an extra year left on his deal. You maybe see, hey, maybe Houston's willing to do something there just to get out from under that extra year of his deal. It's not the best contract going. I think, I can't remember if it's a player option or, it's a non-guaranteed, for the year prior. So maybe he's a trade asset, in that regard too, but he's a guy that obviously doesn't fit Houston's timeline. Maybe they just want out of the money. You could look at a guy like Tim Hardaway Jr. I don't think Dallas is going to be particularly motivated to move off of him, and he's probably a little redundant with what you're doing as the Raptors. A more interesting one is, you know, maybe you look at a Bogdan Bogdanovich. He's been good for the Hawks, but the Hawks could, you know, they got too many guys, and Bogdanovich is good. I don't think they'd want to move off of him, but whether it's to facilitate a three-team deal where they pick up something else and someone else gets Dragic, or they reroute a first or something like that, you know, I think that could be of interest to them. Maybe they ask for one of your depth pieces back too. Like they have no use for Chris Boucher with how many bigs they already have, but maybe they have a use for Malachi Flynn. So that's the kind of guy you're looking at. It, you know, you could try the Bledsoe route if the Clippers just want out of next year's partial guarantee. I don't really see that as a plus move for them if they're on the fringe of the playoff. But this is the tier of guy that you're looking at in a Dragic trade. Now, you could try to piece stuff together to make a more significant move. Like, hey, you could throw Chris Boucher in and then maybe Jeremy Grant can come back, or Gallo or something like that. I think those moves are probably getting a little too big. I think if you're going higher than that on salary and it's not a star, which I don't think it would be, you're probably asking for assets back to take on money. And that's actually where, you know, it's great that Grange laid it out as he did, what the team's intentions are, and that that core four is kind of locked in, and you could probably lock Gary in there for the time being. But one interesting thing that I don't think has been explored yet, and maybe it would require the Raptors to be bad over this next little bit, right? Like maybe they got to go 2-6 in this 8-game stretch against teams that are probably East playoff teams. But the Raptors don't project as a cap space team next year anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're willing to flip Dragic for bad salary. Well, not even bad salary, but like, say an Eric Gordon situation. Say Houston calls you and they're like, hey, we would like to shorten our commitment to Eric Gordon by a year. And I'm not saying this is something that they would do. Eric Gordon is a very valuable, like a very solid player that should have trade value. We're just using him as a stand-in. They call you and say, we really want out of Gordon's money next year because we want to use our cap space and we want to be a player in free agency. Would you swap Eric Gordon for Goran Dragic? And then if you're the Raptors, it's like, well, that eats up a lot of financial flexibility for next year, but you weren't going to be a player in free agency anyway. So maybe that's the situation that you end up trying to use Dragic's money for. Maybe it's a worse contract and you ask for an asset back in that exchange. There's always, you know, there are always deals flying around.
Yeah. And I mean, with Gordon too, like you acquire him. If it doesn't work out for you next year and you want to move on from him, like then he's expiring and a guy who can hit threes. Now, the only concern with him is I don't know if he's going to stay healthy, but he's been healthy so far this year. So that's important. I mean, look, I think I got two questions I really want to ask you. Actually, one of them is really just, I have a list of like really quick trades that I came off on the top of my head, and you just give me a quick yes or no on these. But the other question is like, if you are shopping right now and if you can only acquire one, and let's be real, I don't think the Raptors have that many overwhelming assets to acquire every single weakness that they can, you know, need to address right now. But if you can only address one, the bigger need, is it center or guard for you?
Guard. I think you can do enough with the, hey, we don't have a center, but we have a lot of huge guys. We've seen that can be effective on the offensive glass and in the transition game. I just think you have no chance of scoring with your second unit, really, the way things are structured right now. There just aren't a lot of centers out there. Like, maybe you take a flyer on a Nurkic, maybe Rashawn Holmes becomes available, and those are different discussions, but I think you're probably going to have more luck in the backcourt.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, let's get to that section here where these are fake trades that probably work. Let's start with this one. Eric Gordon for Goran Dragic and a lottery protected first round pick.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably do that. I'd probably fight for harder protections on that, or, you know, make it Flynn in a second or something like that, but Eric Gordon's real good, and he fits what this team needs a lot. That's a 45% three-point shooter.
Yep, there you go. Okay,
with an extra year on his deal. Sorry, I just want to hammer that home because, again, this is, you know, there's mixed reporting on if there are partials on the 2023-2024 part of his deal, but I think it's completely non-guaranteed, and so you get an extra year of Gordon there as well.
Yeah, and they can use him next year too. Terrence Ross for Goran Dragic and a lottery protected first.
No, sorry, Sean Woodley.
You're out of Terrence Ross.
Well, it's just, he's kind of become that Svi level of a shooting specialist who doesn't shoot well. He's only shot above league average once in the last 5 years.
That's a lot of contested shots for Terrence. I agree. Gary Harris and Mo Bamba for Boucher, Dragic, and a lottery protected first.
Gary Harris and Mo Bamba for who?
Boucher, Dragic, and a lottery protected first.
I don't think I throw the first in because Gary Harris's deal isn't great. Oh, okay. So yeah, that's a better factor. Sorry, I didn't have that in front of me. I mean, to get Mo Bamba alone, it's probably a worthwhile flyer. It's just Mo Bamba, you would need to be fairly certain that he's not going to price himself out of your range as a restricted free agent this summer.
Fair enough. All right, we have five more, so, and only 30 seconds, so you're going to have to give me a yes or no. Jakob Poeltl and Doug McDermott for Malachi Dragic and the first lottery protected.
Yes.
Derek White and Doug McDermott for Boucher, Dragic, and lottery protected first. I don't think the Spurs do this one.
I don't do that one either. Doesn't move the needle enough without Yak.
Fair enough. Bledsoe for Dragic straight up, just a salary dump. Maybe you get like an Amir Coffee or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Miles Turner for Dragic and two firsts.
Protections? Yes, no. I do that one
all
anyway.
All these protected. Okay.
Yeah, I do that
and
one.
The last anyway. One. Yeah. Caris LeVert for Dragic and a lottery protected first.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. All right. That's for us today.
Fairly low assets. You're talking about fairly low assets for good guys.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, that does it for us today. I'm your host, Will Liu, and you've been listening to The Raptor Show on Sports FM 90 The Fan. Thanks again to my guest, Blake Murphy, to our board producer, Derek Brandeo, and we will talk to you tomorrow.